to Regenerative Mindset. In this podcast, we'll explore fresh ideas and inspiring stories from trusted voices who share practical wisdom on bringing positive change to our lives, our society, and our world. I'm your host, Stacey Pollice. As a psychologist, regenerative farmer, and climate activist, I've developed a deep curiosity for thriving ecosystems. Whether it's on my avocado ranch in Southern California or in the ways we engage with each other. Join me as I chat with brilliant guests who challenge our thinking and expand our understanding of how we can live more sustainably, healthfully, and regeneratively, to give back more than we take. Together, we'll see how personal healing can create a ripple effect that reaches our communities and even the earth beneath our feet. So let's get curious together. I'm so excited to welcome Josh Friday to this episode. Josh is California's chief service officer, a former mayor, naval officer, and lifetime advocate for civic engagement and collective purpose. His work has reshaped what public service looks like in our time, proving that government can be a force for unity, healing, and regeneration. Under his leadership, California has built the largest service corps in the nation, now larger than the Peace Corps, creating thousands of opportunities for people to serve their communities, address climate change, tackle food insecurity, and prepare for disasters, all while reducing student debt and building connections across divides. Josh's belief is that service is not just about giving back. It's about coming together to find belonging, meaning, and shared hope at a time when many feel disconnected. His unique path has led him from military service to humanitarian relief efforts, and ultimately to engaging roles in local and state government. In each case, his strong values shine through, revealing a deep commitment to building systems that serve people and the planet. In this conversation, we talk about what it means to lead with a regenerative mindset in politics, how community service can bridge division, and why restoring faith in one another might just be the most powerful form of climate and cultural repair there is. Join me for this inspiring and deeply grounding conversation with Josh Friday, a leader showing that hope is something we create together through action, compassion, and service. Hi, Josh. So good to see you here today.
Me too. Thanks for having me. This is going to be fun.
I'm so excited about you. Thank you for joining us because I have some questions and I want to share you with my listeners. First of all, I study Taoism and I like to do an I Ching. And today, for this podcast, it was so perfect. I just want to tell you what it was. It was Hexagram 53, and it's about establishing a proper foundation so that the content grows gradually and will enjoy a long life and a lofty view. That is the auspices that I got. And rapid progress, or when we try to react with our egos in a conflicting situation and we want immediate response, it doesn't always work well. But then there's also the changing lines that tell us ultimately this leads to increase. So powerful improvements underway and lives will be invigorated. That's my feeling about you. I just want to start with that. And from there, I mean, sounds pretty good, right?
Wow, it's amazing. I love that. And I'm blushing.
So let's just start in with your current role as chief service officer. And I hadn't heard of that before. And when I did a little research, now I know why. It's typically not at the state level, but it sounds like you're the first one. So tell us a little bit about what you do as chief service officer and how that came about.
Yeah, I have the coolest job, I think, in the entire world. And most people do not know, especially Californians, that they have a chief service officer. But I love talking about it because I think it says a lot about California and what we value. and what we're investing in and the kind of society we want to live in, which is one where we serve each other, where people take care of each other and support each other. So the chief service officer is a cabinet position that Governor Newsom created to focus on engaging Californians in serving, in volunteering, in coming together and working together to solve problems, but also to have common experiences again at a time when we can feel very isolated and polarized and divided. And so I got appointed after he got elected and have served for the last several years, and we've had a lot of fun and are also making enormous impact. But I actually do think about it, Stacey, as us laying the foundation for the kind of long-term change you just talked about in that quote.
Tell us how that works, and why did Governor Newsom bring you in at that role? Was that just a harebrained idea, or was there some background?
Maybe a little bit of both. Yeah, so some of the background is when I came out of the Navy, I had a chance to serve our country abroad in Japan and in Guantanamo. And when I came home, I started building and running an organization called Next Gen Climate that was founded by Tom Steyer and working in climate politics. But coming home, I could see how frayed our social fabric was coming, how we were being pulled apart, how citizens were becoming more divided, and how few opportunities we had to sort of connect and build common bonds. And so I started thinking about that. Finally, I decided we have to do something about it. And so when I got elected and became mayor of my hometown in Novato, California, I created this program where if you graduated from one of our high schools and you got into our local university and committed to 2 summers of service, you basically got a full ride to college. We called it a local GI Bill. You serve your community, we help you go to school. It's this deeply American idea. And that caught the attention of then Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom, who was running for governor at the time. And he was also recognizing how polarized and divided our country was coming, and he was feeling it on the campaign trail. So he came to me and he said, what would it look like to scale this? So we launched a plan during the campaign to scale service. And part of it was creating a cabinet position. And so after he got elected, he called my bluff. And here we are.
Well, it sounds as though the idea has caught on, and there's a number of other states that have adopted that role.
That's right. Yeah. So Maryland, Governor Moore in Maryland recently created a cabinet position for it as well. And it is catching on, not only the role, but also the models that we've been creating. So that program that I described that we created when I was mayor of Novato has now become College Corps in California. And the way that works is if you commit to 450 hours of service, you get $10,000 towards your education, which is a meaningful amount. That's the amount a Pell Grant student has to come up with by either taking out loans, which is why we have a student debt crisis, or by working. So when I was a Pell Grant student, I cleaned golf carts at the local golf shop. And now we have thousands of students across California at our UCs, our CSUs, our community colleges, who are getting debt-free pathways by serving in their community and by working with other people and by gaining knowledge and skills and purpose and meaning along the way. And then that model for that specific program has now been emulated in other states like Minnesota and New York, who have created their own version of College Corps based off our model. So we see that these ideas that I think are deeply American, but in many ways we lost this sense of calling on people to serve and then creating the opportunity for people to serve. But we're seeing these ideas really catch hold, be impactful, and starting to spread across the country.
I consider it genius. And I just finished a big run of Eleanor Roosevelt. I read 4 2-inch thick books on her life. But the New Deal, it really reminded me of that. I mean, it really does follow that. And I know that my husband's father, who was the son of an immigrant, lived in a coal mining town, worked for the CCC, got dignity, got skills, got work experience, so that when he left his coal mining town, he was actually able to begin as a road worker and ended up building one of the largest road construction companies in the Southwest. And it all, I believe, came from that opportunity he was given as a very young man.
100%. And we see that with our programs. And I'll just point one thing, because there is economic opportunity that's very real. Like I mentioned, we're providing debt-free pathways for students who are now getting hired by the places they're working. So we're creating real pathways for jobs. They're gaining skills. Everything you just mentioned is very real. One of the things I remember studying Eleanor Roosevelt, she really was the champion for national service and the original CCC, Civilian Conservation Corps, was in her mind, it was how we created an equal playing field. It was how we got women into the labor market. It was an opportunity to give everyone a chance to contribute to society, and including marginalized communities, people who had been left out of society before. It gave people a chance to belong, to be part of something. That's why she was so passionate about it. And we see that our College Corps program is the first service program in the country to include our Dreamers, because other programs that are federally funded exclude. You have to be a citizen. They exclude our Dreamers for no good reason, but we made sure to include them. And that's the power of service, is you give people who I think have either been left aside or maybe feel like they've been told by society that they don't have anything meaningful to contribute. And now we're giving them a chance to do something really meaningful and sending a message to them, just like your father-in-law got, that they matter and that they're important and that we welcome them and we need them. And that's a message that I think we need to send to so many more people in our society.
That is so smart, though, because someone who may really have an issue with Dreamers or any other form of person immigrating from another country, because they may be a drain on society, you might think or say, and maybe true at some level, I don't know. And what you're proposing is, these are human resources. If they're here, their opportunity is also our opportunity, where there are services and there is support we need in a state like California, actually only getting larger, our need for support. So that is a question I was going to ask you, was with ICE being such a big deal in California, in my area of Santa Barbara, how does that work? I mean, who gets to participate in these volunteer programs, service programs?
Yeah, so we feel very strongly that everyone has something to contribute, which is why we've made our programs open to everybody, including our Dreamers. But the reality that you just mentioned with ICE, with these horribly discriminatory raids and practices by our federal government, has a chilling effect. There's no doubt about that. I'll give you an example that breaks my heart. I'm going later this week to San Diego to do a kickoff between UC San Diego and San Diego State of our College Corps program. And so we have hundreds of young people that are about to begin their service journey, and we're going to go and celebrate them with local legislators and the mayor and a bunch of other important people. And many of our Dreamers, I've been told, are planning to stay home and not come to the celebration where we're there to celebrate them out of safety concerns, out of fear. What we're making sure that we do in California is send a clear message that we're not backing down. We're going to continue to invest in everybody, because to your point, they are a very valuable asset and an important part of our community with a lot to offer. And so we're going to continue to invest in it. But we are in this reality right now of a federal government that is basically intentionally trying to cause fear, and they're doing it.
I'm so happy to hear that there's at least the ability to participate, gain the connections, the belonging, the sense of unity, because that is massive in the spirit and soul of the human being. But I also want to back up a little, because I know there is a California Service Corps. I want to explain the structure a little bit better. I think is that there's a core that has four programs to it. So if you would explain that a little bit so we could know the full vision.
So we created the California Service Corps that does have four branches. So I'm a veteran, so I think about the Service Corps as the military. And then we have our four branches of service. I talked about one of them, which was our College Corps program. So those are for students that are in school, and creating debt-free pathways for them when they serve, and then they become part of a community. We build a cohort. We make sure they work with people from different backgrounds. And it's a very intentional program to build social cohesion and belonging. And quite frankly, Stacey, I'll just add this before I answer the rest of your question. What we hear when we survey our students that do the program is that many of them sign up for the money. That's what sort of gets them in the door. And then they come back the second year because they feel like for the first time, there's something that they belong to in the community. They use those words. And so it's really powerful. We also created in California the very first climate corps in the country. I mentioned earlier that I used to run Next Gen Climate, which is a national organization focused on the politics of climate change. And what I sort of saw and witnessed is in the climate movement, we would get people very fired up to want to take action. And either we'd scare them or we'd inspire them. And then they'd ask the question, what can I do? And we would say, go vote. And they'd say, great, I just voted. Now what can I do? And we never had an answer. Or at least a good answer. And so when I got this job, the first program we launched actually was our Climate Corps program to really empower Californians to take action to mobilize and organize in their community. And so right now, since we launched and we just celebrated our fifth year, we've had thousands of young people who get paid to take climate action for a year in our communities. They're part of a cohort, they're part of a community. And then they get a scholarship to college or to pay down debt when they finish the program. And usually the program is about 11 months, almost a year. And then our climate corps is now spread to 12 other states. And then also was the model when President Biden created the American Climate Corps before he left office. And unfortunately, President Trump got rid of the American Climate Corps, but it showed the power of this idea. And then we created a youth service corps really to focus on non-college track young people, formerly incarcerated young people, foster youth, low-income folks who are having a hard time getting the labor market, to give them the chance to experience what it means to be able to contribute to your society and also help them on a job path. We do a lot of wraparound resources with that program. And then all of the AmeriCorps programs for the state run through our office as well. So those are the four programs. We have College Corps, Climate Corps, our Youth Service Corps, and AmeriCorps. And all together combined, our California Service Corps, and Governor Newsom was just with President Clinton at the Clinton Global Initiative last week on stage, bragging about how we in California are now bigger than the entire Peace Corps with what we've built.
God, that is amazing. Well, that is something to brag about, I would say. And it's interesting because I personally wasn't that aware of AmeriCorps, but that is something that President Clinton created in 1993, it looks like. And so it's a variety of types of service. And is California have its own specific branch? Does every state have its own specific branch? And then I guess what I'm trying to get to eventually is, I know that you had mentioned to me that there were volunteers sent into LA after those fires that were trained and ready to go. And I'm wondering, like, what program do those folks come from? Like, is that the AmeriCorps people?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a combination of our programs. And that's really, honestly, what I think is the power of what we've built right now, back to that foundation that we started with, is we built a foundation where no matter what the social issue is, and during COVID, it was our food banks needed to remain operational at a time when we lost all of our volunteers, because they're mostly seniors and older Californians. The need skyrocketed. I got put in charge of the food task force by the governor to keep our food banks operational. So we had to deploy the National Guard. We also had to deploy all of our service members to keep food banks going. During the fires, I was there on the first night in LA, the fire started, and I went straight from the Burbank airport, where we almost didn't land because planes were having a hard time landing because the wind was so intense. Went straight to the Pasadena Conference Center, where the shelter was being set up for over 1,000 families, people who just lost their homes. And it was being set up by the Red Cross and our AmeriCorps members. That's who was setting up and running the entire shelter. And then after that, our College Corps members stepped in, and our College Corps members were running the disaster resource centers and helping man the resource centers that were helping families sign up for FEMA, get resources, figure out where they were going to go next. And then our Climate Corps members stepped in and were actually helping run the food banks that were feeding all the families who just lost their homes. So it was an example where when a disaster struck and California needed it, our service corps was able to jump in feet first and get the job done, and we're ready to go. It was inspiring. And then, of course, and this is always what we see in disasters, where it brings the best out of all of us. We just saw Angelinos step up in such a beautiful and compassionate way, where thousands of volunteers came out. It was the best of LA. It was the best of California. It was the best of humanity. And it shows in times of need why it's so important to create the opportunity for people to contribute, to lend a hand. And I just look at where we are now in our political crisis and where our nation is, and it's why I'm so passionate about why and how we need to scale service, because it really is an all hands on deck moment right now.
Well, that is an understatement. And I would say what you described there, I can relate to, because Santa Barbara experienced the Thomas fires and the debris flow. And there were organic grassroots organizations that came up throughout of it. And one was called the Bucket Brigade, started out very small. And then SB Strong and these networks that were created spontaneously. And it was a feel-good thing. Ooh, I have chills saying it. Because what you're describing in Pasadena, I know that feeling. But then afterward, we don't want that feeling to fade. And sometimes it does. We don't have an opportunity built into the way we live to serve and volunteer. And there's something gained through giving that one receives that you can't quite explain, but is absolutely the most precious.
You nailed it. And so it's one of the reasons we also have created a program called Neighbor to Neighbor, which is sort of modeled after the Bucket Brigade, which is how do we create networks of neighborhoods where people can get to know their neighbors and then be ready for disaster situations, but also to be proactive, to beautify their neighborhood, to take climate action together. And what we know from research is that if you actually get to know six of your neighbors, it improves your physical health and your mental health. There's real research around this. But if you ask most people now, they can't name six of their neighbors. I mean, we have created this society that is almost anti-human. It's like we are animals that like our competitive advantage is that we live in communities and we collaborate. And yet we've set up this society where we're also isolated from each other and we're disconnected. And it's why we have a loneliness crisis, according to the Surgeon General, in our society. I think the existential question is that's driving all of our political problems, all of our challenges in our democracy is, how do we create communities? How do we build communities where people can feel connected, not just at a time of a fire or a flood or a disaster, but all the time? Because that's what we actually need. I often talk about it, and you're much more versed in this than I am, but I often talk about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, where you have your basic needs of food and water, and then you have above that physical safety, which is important. And then the one above that on your way to enlightenment that not enough people talk about, including politicians, certainly don't talk about it, is what you talked about earlier, love and belonging. It's an actual need. When you got goosebumps, I think what you were referencing is like, it's something that we desperately need as human beings. And yet in our society, we don't have the opportunities to do it. And that's what we're trying to fix and turn around here in California.
Well, the title of this podcast is Regenerative Mindset. And what you're describing is a healing and a restoring of positive life force and love as the ultimate. But love converts into sunshine and rain when you're using land metaphor. I live on an avocado farm and I see it at this point in my life in all things, which is why you're on the show today, because I really hear it in the way that you're practicing. And I suppose you call what you do politics. It doesn't feel like it. But ultimately, there's a desire for lifting all boats and a healing and a restoring of the community and a collaboration with rather than a control over things. These are all principles in regenerative farming as in mindset and life. So yeah, I'm wondering if you think of it that way at all.
I absolutely think of it. I love that you use the word healing. I had this experience that I'll never forget the rest of my life where a couple of years ago, one of the head of the community colleges invited me down to go visit a program of foster youth down in Southern California. And she was a foster youth herself who was leading the community colleges. She had me come down and I spent the day with a group of foster youth. And at the end of the day, she said to me, she said, Josh, the reason I wanted you to come down and spend time with these young people is because I wanted you to see that when you ask foster youth, what do you want to be when you grow up? You'll most often hear things like social worker or teacher or healthcare worker. And she said, it's because service is how we heal. And now I got goosebumps just saying that. I brought that back to my entire team. And in my mind, if you think about where we are as a nation, and how deeply sick, I would say, we are as a culture, and also how deeply impacted and really unhealthy our environment is and our climate and our planet. It's the question, how do we heal? How do we heal our planet? How do we heal our culture? How do we heal each other? Where we have a mental health crisis that is ravaging our young people. We have a loneliness crisis that we talked about earlier where our seniors are left isolated and disconnected too often. So the question is, how do we heal? That's the question we're asking. And in my mind, I take from that example of the foster youth, and I think to myself, if we are all given the chance to serve, if we're all given the chance to be part of something, to be connected, that's how we begin to heal. And we can connect with each other and we can connect with the earth. And in my mind, that's the most regenerative thing we could possibly do, which is why I think we have to keep trying to scale these kinds of programs and think about politics. And we do need to rebrand it. We need a politics that focuses on building communities. that's how we actually solve all these problems, whether it's climate change or poverty or economic opportunity, I think is by creating more connected communities. And so when I think about what our job is as leaders or as political figures, the foundation of that in my mind is about building community and building connection.
You are speaking my language, is all I can say. What about elders? I hear a lot about what you're doing for school age youth, it sounds like. But I'm wondering, is there a place for elders, people that are retired? You know, talk about a loneliness crisis. And I wonder, is there a place in the system for that?
Not only a place, there's a need. One of the things we do, our climate corps, what they do is they organize community climate action days around the state. I just was in LA for a whole day of action when we had over 2,000 volunteers throughout the city and county of LA. And what was beautiful about it is it was almost equal young people and equal seniors. And it's an opportunity for everyone to come together, intergenerational exchanges, work side by side, get dirty, get to know each other. If we look at one of our biggest challenges right now, let's look at education, for instance, and learning loss coming out of COVID. Reality where too many of our young people are falling behind and not getting to third grade reading level. What our educational advisors, with the experts, of which I'm not one, but what the experts say, one of the most important things we can do is give them what's called high dosage tutoring, which means give them individualized attention from a tutor so that student can have the chance to catch up and stay on track. Well, guess what? If we did this right, and if we engaged and built the infrastructure right, there is an entire army out there of retired Californians with experience and wisdom and knowledge and passion and compassion who could be solving this problem for us. The challenge is we just, I don't think, have thought creatively enough about how do we deploy people, create the infrastructure to make it easy, and then actually call on people and say, we need you once you retired. Like, it's not okay to just go away and sail off into the sunset. We actually need you. And here's how we're going to deploy you. And I think a lot of people, my parents included, would be very welcome to hearing that message.
And so would I. And I did a lot of research in education. I did a small research on student well-being in public school. And then out of that, I was inspired to do teachers in the Santa Barbara Secondary School. And what I found is how much landed on teachers' shoulders for the development and learning, but on all levels. I mean, it's not just reading, writing, arithmetic. I mean, they really see themselves as life mentors and guides, and they are that at the best. But there's just not enough time to go around with larger classrooms. And I felt so strongly that we need to tap the community because there's plenty of people that could come in and help. And it would be helping the teacher and helping students, and it would help the elders have a purpose. So if you think about doing this, when you're lieutenant governor, you call me.
We have to do this. We don't have any other choice. The point you had about a sort of a top-down approach versus how do we support the community, I think we need to look ourselves in the mirror because I think our party, I'm a Democrat, I'm running for lieutenant governor as a Democrat. I think our party's been guilty of this by saying, government's going to be the answer. Government's going to solve the problem. You just go on with your life and some program will take care of it. And it's actually not how democracy is supposed to work. And it's actually not deploying what Eleanor Roosevelt saw, which was our most important asset, which is our people. And so we need to rethink how we configure our politics, but also our communities, where the first question we're asking is when we identify a problem, and you've identified a huge problem. My wife is an elementary school teacher. She's incredible, and she has 30 kids in her classroom, and there's no way she can give every kid the attention that they deserve and need. And so if you identify that problem, the place we should be starting is not necessarily, do we need more money? And of course, I would always argue for more resources for education. The question is, how do we deploy our people, our community, and call on everybody to be part of the solution? We have not done that as a society, and I think we're seeing the consequences of it.
I agree. And I see what you're talking about as leaving resources on the table, so to speak. And it's interesting because in so using, you don't use it up, you uplift both the young people that now have a relationship with this mentor tutor, and you have actually uplifted this elder who now has purpose beyond retirement. How many people do we know that once they don't have their career anymore, they've lost identity? And this is such a okay, we're going to do this. We got a lot of listeners here that are going to hold us to it. But you mentioned being a Democrat, and I feel that right now there's this big either or and us against them kind of game in politics. Maybe it's always been there. I suppose it has. But I see a message. How are you going beyond that binary, which is just set up for conflict? And if you do this, I'm going to do that. That doesn't make my heart sing. So how are you going to move beyond that so that everybody, regardless of whatever party they vote for, can really be helped by this and get behind what you're up to here as Lieutenant Governor in 2026?
I had this honor of a lifetime this last spring to give the commencement speech at my alma mater at UC Berkeley. And in the commencement speech, I said to the graduating class of 2025, I said, you've been sold a BS narrative. And it's a narrative of zero-sum politics, which is that if we win, they lose. We've been sold it by people for the last generation for their own benefit. And then, of course, I went on to challenge a class to step up and serve and find ways to serve throughout their lives. But I think part of what we have to do is redefine self-interest, honestly. And we've been told that what's in our interest is to be in this fight all the time. And it's actually not true. It's total BS. What is in our self-interest is to be collaborative, to work together, and to see ourselves as being one community, and then to help each other. I think the obvious reasons of like, that's how you solve problems and that's how you get stuff done. But the more personal reasons of what you touched upon before, which is part of the needing to be loved and belong is not just to receive love. I actually think we have a need to love. We have to be given the chance to love something. It's why serving the military was such an incredible experience, because you got a chance to demonstrate your love of country. You got a chance to give, and there was enormous pride in that. There was enormous satisfaction in that. And so if we don't give people the chance to love something else, and we just tell them the only thing you should do is look out for yourself, and if you disagree with someone, they're the enemy. We tell them that. I actually think we're leading them down the wrong path. It's why we have so much anxiety in our society. It's why we have so much unhappiness and loneliness. So I think part of it is identifying that there's this BS narrative out there around zero-sum politics, and then redefining self-interest. Now, I don't have all the answers, so I'd love to hear what you think, honestly, about this. But you've identified what is an existential problem in our society.
Well, I practice Taoist martial arts and Qigong. And so the way energy works is that for me to send you energy, it has to go through my system. So if I want to hate on you, it has to go through me. So unfortunately, I'm sort of poisoning myself on my way to really nailing you. And if I choose to say that person must really be wounded in some essential way, that they might want to harm people for no good reason, let's just pretend that's who I'm seeing as the person I'm opposing here, and I just send them unconditional love that they may heal, that actually uplifts me on my way to uplifting my enemy. That is the physics of how that actually works. And I would dare you to try it. And I have actually done it with people I've had a hard time with. If I flip it around and I choose to send what I'm looking for to them, and I've been able to heal and forgive, I believe it also takes a modicum of grace as well, but I believe that is true. And that's the why of being generous actually ends up giving you more than receiving sometimes even.
I love that. I've never heard that particular explanation, but it makes total sense. I always talk to my kids, my three boys, about how the energy you put out in the world will come back to you in some way. The challenge is when you have leaders in a media ecosystem that is encouraging you to spew out negative energy, that's where you're going to be led. And that's what we have to fight against. That's where we have to change our politics and change how we do things.
It's doubly difficult to do when you are facing kind of an ugly, what would you call it, mudslinging, nasty, you know, it's hard. We all have egos and we all get triggered and we want to meet that challenge. What I was going to say also was that Darwin talks about dog eat dog, okay, survival of the fittest. But literally what he also talked about that didn't get any ink until out of Berkeley, gosh, I'm not coming up with the name. There was a great guy that wrote a book about it's survival of the most nurturing, you know, the nurturing and care factor actually during peacetime that actually helps evolve. Now, during wartime, survival of the fittest comes in. You know, the fact is that it's not one-sided. I mean, we've adopted that warrior mentality, and it's interesting because you've been in many different sectors of our society, having been a warrior and also having been a nurturer. I suppose there are times for each, but if you can, I think that loving kindness piece is really effective, more than you think.
I remember the book Sapiens, which, and I know you're a lover of books. The book Sapiens talks about the competitive advantage of our species, of Homo sapiens, is that we work together and we create a village and a community. That is our competitive advantage compared to other animals. And so the question is, for the benefit of our species, we have to figure out ways to work together, because that is like how we continue to progress and evolve. I talked about earlier, it almost feels like we're creating anti-human society because we're creating these structures and these cultures that are doing the exact opposite. And I think it's really harming us.
I would agree with you. So I want to make sure and make a point here about the fact that you are running for lieutenant governor and you're our favorite pick. But tell us a little bit about why you're running and what the primary looks like and what you're hoping to achieve.
Well, first of all, your endorsement means the world to me. So thank you so much. That's the most important. And I'm very grateful for that. And I think the lieutenant governor position in California is this really exciting position that most people have no idea what it does and what their responsibilities are. But I'm running for lieutenant governor. It's this unique position that'll give me the chance to scale these programs we've been talking about, these service programs, and to make California, I think, the first state to have universal service. And that the reason is that the lieutenant governor is the only position in California that sits on all three boards of higher education. So our UC Regents, our CSU trustees, and our Community College Board of Governors. So it's a really important role for higher education and workforce development, and a chance to build service into our education system, which is what my plan to create universal service does. And it's also a chance to build it into our high school systems. And I was just with the chancellor, head of the entire community college system yesterday, talking about our plan to create credit, college credit, for those who serve while they're in high school, a summer service, semester of service, so we can create real economic opportunity, like Eleanor Roosevelt talked about and your father-in-law received, and we can create real job pathways to a trade certificate or a community college by serving and by being part of something and by connecting with others. So I'm very passionate about this. And then I also think, and this is equally as important, we haven't had a chance to talk about this yet, but I hope we do. We have a real challenge right now where over 70% of Californians no longer believe what my parents believed, which is that even though neither one of them had a college degree and they often struggled, they believed that they could send their son to great California public schools from kindergarten all the way through law school, which is what I got to do here in California, and that I would have a better life. And most people don't believe that. And that's because for too many, California's become too expensive. It's become too hard to live. It's become too hard to imagine your kids being able to come back and get a home in the community that they grew up in. And so I'm really focused on making it easier to build homes and making it easier to build clean energy, which is something that I think is absolutely critical to reduce costs and also make sure that we hit our very ambitious climate goals of being carbon neutral by 2045. And the lieutenant governor, again, not just plays a key role in education, but also plays a key role on the Coastal Commission, the Ocean Protection Council, and the State Lands Commission. So it's a really important role, I think, to accomplish those three things I just talked about: clean energy, homes, and universal service. And so I'm very excited, and I think there's a lot that can be done, and something that place where I think we can have a real impact.
We need you very much, because when you talk about that Coastal Commission, it takes me right back. I have had the Environmental Defense Council on this show 2 times, and I care very much about this sable oil off the coast of Santa Barbara and the damage they've already created, you know, Exxon before them. But what can anyone do about that, or what would one do about that?
The lieutenant governor does sit on the State Lands Commission, which does play a role in oversight. The challenge with this particular pipeline, of which I've spent a lot of time thinking about and looking into and hearing from people in Santa Barbara, is there's multiple agencies that have a say in it. And so it's important for people to have their voice heard across not just the State Lands Commission and the lieutenant governor's office, but all of the agencies across state government and also the federal government. There's a federal role here as well. And I cut my teeth in climate politics, leading the fight and helping lead the fight, working with organizations across the country against the Keystone Pipeline. That's where I got my start in climate politics and believe strongly that we should not be investing in old 19th century infrastructure, that we have to be doubling down on the clean energy future that we need. You know, making sure people have their voices heard, but also laying out a vision for not just how we, you know, stop the bad infrastructure, but how do we actually build the clean energy that we need in order to meet the needs of our society and reduce bills for hardworking families. And that's where we as Democrats also have to look ourselves in the mirror, I think. And I talk about this, that I don't think we can be the party anymore that says climate change is an existential crisis. Look people in the eye and say that, which I actually happen to believe it is. And then let it take years for a clean energy project to be built or a solar project. We have got to think about how to have some urgency in creating the clean energy that we actually need in our state so that we don't have to be thinking about old 19th century, 20th century infrastructure that's only going to pollute and harm our communities.
That's the concern, is that when we're fast tracking something that we know is going to need cleanup ongoing and perhaps even in a very large way in the semi-near future, that just seems like a bad plan. But I know it's complicated. Well, so this is important, and I think the election that is coming up in 2026, I wish you were alone on the ballot, but I think there's a primary for you to get through. And what do we need to know, those of us? I mean, as soon as I really got a sense of you, I made my first donation, and I'm going to keep doing what I can to make sure that you get elected. But what are you up against? What are your odds? What do you need? How can we support this, those of us that really love the way you're building a healthy, regenerative foundation for everyone? So how do we get behind this for you to represent us?
Yeah, appreciate that question so much. And your contribution does make a big difference. California is a very expensive state to run, statewide especially. It's such a big state. And so unfortunately, with our system, I wish we didn't have to fundraise, but fundraising is a big part of it. And so your support and anyone else out there who's willing to support, it does make a massive difference. And we've had a great start to our fundraising efforts. We have to keep building the momentum, but it is a competitive primary. I think, honestly, Stacey, the way this race is going to shape up is there's going to be a clear choice. I think there's going to be a clear choice for voters to have the chance to decide between candidates who have been in elected office for a long time and have been in Sacramento for a long time, and then the chance to elect a new generation of leaders. And I also think the leaders to have the courage to say, we need to do things differently. We have to approach government differently. We have to be honest that government can't solve every problem. And we need to empower our people to be part of the solution in a big way. And that's what I'm running on. I hope to represent that new generation of leadership in our party. And for those who want to be part of that and want to be part of a new approach and doing things differently, I'd love for you to go to our website, which is joshfriday.com, sign up to volunteer, sign up to host a meet and greet or an event, and then also join me in pushing to make it easier to build communities and to connect people and bring people together. That's what it's going to take to solve these big challenges that we're facing. And I want that work to start now, and then it's going to continue after I get elected.
Beautiful. And my brain, the way it works is I'm looking at the mycorrhiza, sort of that fungus networking, and that's what works in nature. That's how we make those connections. So that's the thing. And it is also mirrored by the fascia in the whole entire body is all connected. It's one thing. It's a new discovery, apparently, the fascia. And it unifies this body, but there are holes among holes. And so I see what you're describing fits within that holistic view of a community and a state.
I hope so. And we may have discovered it, but I promise you, people for thousands of years have understood, indigenous communities and others, that we are all connected. We are all part of the same energy. And so I hope we get back to a broader enlightenment, a broader understanding of what actually is real. And that's what you described, and that's what I'm hoping to get us back to.
Hooray, Josh. Okay, so what are you reading now?
I'm juggling a couple books. They're both fun and interesting, and they're very different ways. One is called Recoding America by Jennifer Palka, and it's about some of the challenges that, quite frankly, we have in the government we've built that's become very bureaucratic and very unflexible, and as a result, has a hard time delivering on the results and the outcomes that I think all of us would expect and want. I've asked everyone on my team, my executive team, to read it, because I think we do need to think about government being more flexible in a lot of ways in order to actually improve people's lives. So that's one. And then maybe the more fun one for the audience is a close friend recommended and lent me A Gentleman in Moscow, which I am on chapter 2 of.
I've heard about that. Okay. If you had a magic wand, what would you change?
I would change how we finance elections in America and create public financing. Maybe I'm too singularly focused on raising money for campaigns right now. That's what comes to mind.
It's a good one, though. And I'm going to tell your wife that when I interviewed 150 teachers, secondary teachers, their answer was smaller class size. I mean, it could have been a lot of things, and you could call it money, but like everything boils down to too many kids in a class for one teacher.
One of the things I'm really interested in, Stacey, is, and we have started having real conversations about this, is where we are going with AI and how disruptive it's going to be for our economy. And one of the things I've been thinking about, and I was just talking to my wife about this over Honey Nut Cheerios the other day in the morning, talking about how her class, she has 30 kids, and California recommends you should have 15 kids for every one teacher. She has 30 at a public school. But how thinking about as many people, and there will be a whole generation of people potentially displaced by AI, could we be thinking about a world where we had only 10 kids for every teacher because we redeployed a whole new generation into teaching? I think it's really exciting to think about the opportunity we might have to deploy people, back to your point about using our assets, deploying people in new ways that could actually solve the classroom size issue or could solve the loneliness issue with seniors by sending a whole army of people out to go visit seniors at their house and help them with therapy or whatever the issue is. So I think some really interesting conversations about, given what AI is going to bring, how do we tackle these issues in a way that solves some of the same problems like classroom sizes?
We so have to return to this, Josh, because you're right on. I'm with you on that. I don't want to get off the phone, but if we have to, then I'm going to just say, are there just any key takeaways? I mean, you have so many different points of view, from your military to your nonprofit to your legal to your disaster relief to your tremendous belief in service. And like, how do we be more like Josh just in our everyday?
Well, then maybe I'll answer that with just a quick story, if that's okay. Because when I think about that question, I think about being in Japan, stationed there when I was in the Navy on a Friday afternoon, when a 9.0 earthquake hit. This was a 3-minute long earthquake. It was like nothing I'd ever experienced. And ultimately led to a tsunami that instantly killed tens of thousands of people, displaced hundreds of thousands of people, and then led to the Fukushima nuclear disaster. And I was on base a few days after the earthquake when my boss called me into her office, the captain, and she said, you have 1 hour to grab your sea bag and head down to Okinawa and join the admiral that was going to be overseeing the entire disaster relief effort. And my wife, who was 3 months pregnant at the time, was immediately evacuated and sent home back to the United States. And I said goodbye to my wife, not knowing when I would see her again. But I got to be part of what would become Operation Tomodachi, one of the largest humanitarian aid and disaster relief efforts in military history. And the reason I share that story is because what I learned from it. And I share that story not because I was the hero, quite the opposite. I played a very small role, but I got to be part of something and I got to have a role. What I learned from that was to get through a crisis, and right now our country is in a crisis, but to get through a crisis, everybody has a role to play and everyone has to play that role. And what I would say to anyone who's listening to this is you have a really important role to play right now. You have an important role to play to step up as a volunteer and mentor and serve in your community. You have an important role to play to push your government, your local government, and your state government to be better, to be more efficient, to be stronger, to help create more opportunities for service and for people to come together. And you can have a really important role to play in my campaign to help me get elected. So there's a role for you to play in a meaningful way. And right now, the only way we get through where we are as a country right now, as a society, is if you play that role, and we need you. And that's what I would say.
That's beautiful. And you've actually inspired me to get more involved. I stay out of the political effort in general because I don't always feel as deeply connected. And this is connected all the way through. So thank you so much for sharing yourself with us today, Josh. So yeah, vote for Josh Friday. But there's a primary, and anything you can do to get us past that line, I think. When is that? Tell us the date.
June 2nd, 2026. So we're about 8 months away, and we're doing events all around the state, and we're raising money, and we're raising friends, and we'd love to have you join.
Thank you for tuning in. If today's conversation inspired you, you can help us reach more people by sharing this episode with friends or leave a review. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. For additional resources, you can visit my website and stay connected with me on social media. A big thanks to the amazing team that makes this podcast possible, including Phil Svitek, Brianna Phipps, Leah Pellegrini, Melissa Walbridge, and Courtney Hamilton. When we all work together, we can create a world where positive change is not just possible, but inevitable.